Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Talk, the only unified platform for reservations, takeout, and event management. Switch to Talk today to increase your revenue and reach 19 million loyal and engaged guests around the country. Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. It is Wednesday, July 14th, 2021. This is our 295th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talent in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is a prolific writer who has a new cookbook out, and I will introduce him fully in a moment. First, as I do on every show, I will start out with my PR tip, and then later we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to be prolific. Yes, be fruitful and highly productive, producing an abundance of content. Being prolific can be helpful in becoming better in your line of work, whatever that may be. So let's work hard and be bountiful, as content is king. That's my tip today. Now, I'm really excited to have my guest joining me. It is Joshua David Stein. He is a Brooklyn-based prolific writer and the author of many books, cookbooks, and children's books, including his latest and first solo cookbook, Cooking for Your Kids at Home with the World's Greatest Chefs. Joshua is the co-author of Notes from a Young Black Chef with Kwame Anwuachi, the Namwa Tea Parlor Cookbook with Wilson Tang, plus he's written Can I Eat That?, What's Cooking?, The Invisible Alphabet, and so many more. Formerly the editor-at-large at the parenting site Fatherly, Joshua is also the author of To Me, He Was Just Dad. So without further ado, hi, Joshua. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Can't complain.
Can't complain. I mean, you've written so many books and you've written so much. I guess I can complain. I'm sorry. Say it again.
I said, I guess I can complain, but I'm not going
to. Well, it's impressive. It's really impressive. But why don't you take us back a little bit to how you got started writing? Is that something you always wanted to do when you were growing up?
I went to NYU. And I studied ethnomusicology, which is not a very applicable major. And part of that, however, was taking a writing class, which I really resonated with the teaching, I guess, the classes. And then when I got out into the real world, I was a dancer at the time doing ballet and modern. And I realized that probably wasn't going to support the lifestyle that I would like to lead. Not that writing does either. But I got to write about music. I could write about anything I wanted. So it was kind of inexhaustible. And and at a certain point, I guess, thinking back to it, it was like either I tried to become a full-time professional dancer or I had gotten the opportunity and was a recipient of enough privilege that I could do an unpaid internship at Harper's magazine, and I decided to go the Harper's route. And then that kind of propelled me into a career as a writer.
Wow, amazing. I had known you dance, but I didn't realize it was like almost like your career, or it was your career initially.
Yeah, well, I think as for many dancers, it's not a financially viable career, but it was what I wanted to do for my life.
Yeah, well, I think that's very cool. And so how did you then start writing about food and chefs versus, I'd say, doing a beat on dancing or more the arts?
Well, the technical or like factual explanation is I started writing about travel for a Gawker blog, which no longer exists. It's called Grid Skipper. And then I got moved over to Gawker. This was in the mid-aughts, I guess. And my title was After Hours Editor, which everyone thought that meant I was a night editor. But what it actually meant was I covered things that were after hours, like restaurants and like nightlife. So that kind of propelled me into more of a gossipy world of restaurants as opposed to food and cookbooks. And to be honest, it took me a long time to make the transition from writing about restaurants to writing about food. I still do both. Like, I was a restaurant critic for the New York Observer, which I ended up resigning from, and then the Village Voice, which has since folded. And now I am the restaurant critic for Avenue Magazine. So I still do a fair amount of restaurant criticism, but there are no books that are collections of restaurant criticism. So if I wanted to move into a more sustainable sort of career path, cookbooks would be the way to go.
Yeah, I'm thinking, yet there aren't books on that, huh?
You know, believe me, I've tried to pitch them. The issue is, for so many restaurants that you write about, 2 years after you write about them, they're closed. So unless you can
Yeah.
justify a compendium based solely on the quality of writing, which is hard, it's not really viable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember when you were at Grid Skipper, and I remember and reading you with the New York Observer and along your career path, because I feel we've both been in this game for about the same amount of time, I guess. But so what was your first book then? When did that come out?
Well, my first book was when I was at Grid Skipper. It was, well, I guess it was a first book. I rewrote or I updated a travel guide for a British publisher named Thames and Hudson, who was a great publisher, called Style City. And then I kind of semi did books. Like, I did two books for the luxury collection that were put out by Asseline. Those were kind of like vanity projects for Asseline. I mean, for luxury collection. And but my first real book, I would say, was Food and Beer, which is a cookbook that I did with Jeppe Bergsøe from Evil Twin, who at the time was working with a chef named Daniel Burns at a place called Luxus. Well, it's called Torst, the name, but there was a restaurant in the back which had a Michelin star, and it was the first Michelin star for a beer only tasting menu restaurant. So that was with Fiden, and that book came out simultaneously, actually, to a children's book that came out called Can I Eat That? So those two books came out at, I think, the same year. And then since then, I think I've published children's books and cookbooks simultaneously, I think every year, but I would have to go back and check.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing. And I mean, in some books you've done on your own and some you've had co-authors with. I mean, what's, do you prefer one over the other, or do you just like kind of mixing it up?
I think for myself, one of the things I consider when I'm doing a project is if it will be of service and how it can be of service. And I think at this stage in my life, I can be more helpful in lending my writing skills, I guess, and bookmaking skills, which is at some point creative and then at some point just project management. I can be more of service doing that for someone else or with in collaboration with someone else.
Yeah.
Even this book that came out now, Cooking for Your Kids, yeah, it's my name on the cover, but it's like 60 of the world's greatest chefs, and each one or some, there's a score of couples. They provided two recipes. What I did was I curated the list. I wrote the head notes. I adapted the recipes for the home chef. I did the sidebars. Like, I turned their expertise into this project, but it didn't stem from me. And I feel comfortable and happiest, I think, being a doula for other people's knowledge, other people's stories, than the generator.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's talk more a little bit more about this book because I have it here, and I mean, the list of chefs that you have involved is quite amazing, and I love that you have so many couples. It's really cool, and from going through or you know kind of skimming through the different recipes, it's quite a range of recipes.
Yeah, well, it's quite a range of chefs from around the world. And that was extremely important to me, that it not be so United States centric, that it not be, white male centric.
Right.
And I wanted to really showcase the diversity of dishes but then really also like the diversity of wildly talented chefs from around the world. So, doing this book, part of the work was once the recipes were in, but a big part of it was the thing I'm most proud of, other than the illustrations, which I'm also proud of, which
right,
I did.
Right, you did them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that I do feel like, to the extent that the best I could do, and I could always do better, but to the extent that I could, I tried to make it a truly global and diverse selection of chefs.
Yes, and you did. Did you test the recipes for all the chefs?
Yeah, I cook. I mean, you'll see in the book that you won't know, but some of those shots I took of the dishes I made because the chef couldn't, for one reason or the other, provide a photograph. But yeah, I tested them. I tested them more because I wanted to feed my kids than I did for accuracy. But in doing so, I of course.
Yeah. Did your kids have any favorites or any dishes that they were absolutely no way am I eating this?
Well, if I'm honest.
Well, because I'm looking, there's like calves liver from like Daniel Rose and Maria Rose. Like there's some dishes that aren't necessarily dishes I think people would say are at least more like kids dishes as traditionally maybe in America.
Yeah. I mean, there are some, like I also did not make Jacques Onfrio's kangaroo tails.
Okay.
Although you can make it with oxtail.
Hard kangaroo, maybe.
Yeah, but if I'm 1,000% honest, and I've talked about it, so it's not like I'm breaking any news here, sadly.
Well, but you
like,
could be.
I could be. My kids don't eat anything I make, like, at all. My younger son, Augie, eats chicken nuggets. I made him a chicken nugget sandwich with a side of chicken nuggets, which I'm kind of proud of. And my older son doesn't eat anything whatsoever. And it's been a bummer. It's been something I struggle with. I think what I realize is it has so little to do with the food and so much more to do with my interpersonal relationship with them. But it's also important, I think, for me to talk about that in the context of the book, because so often these parenting resources are given. They're also given from a point of view that the person sharing this knowledge has figured it out. And I haven't. And yet, I still think I do have something to offer. And it's not just me, but it's the chefs have something to offer. And a lot of them haven't figured it out either. So, having worked in the parenting space for so long, I find that sometimes advice, which is meant to be helpful, can be alienating because you want to see the vulnerability of the person giving the advice as well. Like they're not at the end stage where everything's working out for them. I'm certainly not at the end stage of this. And we'll see,
Well, I don't have kids, but I've worked with many chefs and just people in the industry with kids, and I feel it's pretty common, or at least I've heard a lot that, their kids don't necessarily want to eat their cooking, or they're very picky eaters. So I think it just is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing for a lot of chefs that I've spoken to about it is, like I was talking to Sean Brock about this the other day, who's in the book. If for his son's Leo, for his first solid, he boiled and pureed and seasoned these like six heirloom squashes, and he had a speech about where they came from and all of this stuff. And he was so excited to give that to Leo, and Leo took one bite and just gagged and just wouldn't eat it. And I think the challenge, not just for food, but for so many things, and especially for chefs, is not to be so attached to your child's response. They have their own stuff going on. It's not a, when you get defensive or you get offended or hurt, I mean, you can get hurt, it's natural, but not to take it so personally. And I think for a lot of chefs, they spend their nights and most of their days making food. They're so invested in it that people think it's delicious. So to come home and have the person closest to you not want to eat it can be tough, for sure. And the chefs in the book that I found that I resonate with the most are the ones who have said, "Look, my kid is just gonna have turkey sandwiches. That's what they want. That's what I'll make them." Or like just pasta with butter. Like the most, it's not like the book is filled with those recipes. But in the head notes and in the sidebars, a lot of them talk about their failure. I don't even want to say failures, their challenges as a parent too. And to me, I want people to pick up the book and I want them to get 100 recipes that they wouldn't have had before, but also to understand that everyone's struggling. They're not alone in it.
No, it's a great book. It's beautiful. I love the illustrations. I love the way it's organized. It's very easy to find which to that you showcase where to get the chef's other recipes that are in the book, because they have more than one, and that you are, I think I saw in the notes it said you have 30 countries covered here. So that's impressive. For such a range. How long did it take you to put this together?
Oh, years, years. I think maybe a year.
A lot. I
I
mean,
was
a lot of
working
time.
on a lot of other projects too, and it wasn't like it was all year doing this full time, but really, the lion's share, the book had like, I guess the genesis of the book had distinct phases. One of them was the cure. One of them was conceptual. One of them was curating the list of chefs. One of them was after reaching out. One of them was like chasing after chefs every day. And then, a lot of these chefs, once we've decided who they were, not every chef is interested or has a bandwidth or whatever, to respond to emails in a timely manner, and they don't make books. So there's a lot of not creative, just logistical wrangling. And then all of those interviews, which were my favorite part. I love talk. That's my favorite thing about writing is listening. And then there was a whole part after that of getting all the text in and, well, you know, like format, you know, just the mm-hmm. making of the actual book. But all in, I think, a year.
Yeah, well, you did it, and it's great. I'm very happy with have my copy. So, and it's a Fiden book, which they always do beautiful books. So, yeah, it's awesome. And so, let's talk a little bit about Fatherly, because that I was listening to a couple of your podcasts that are tied to Fatherly, and it's. I was really enjoying it. I just listened to the one with Massimo Bottura and John Legend. I mean, you had some big names that you're talking to. So
yeah, unfortunately, I haven't done that podcast in a while. I'm not with Fatherly anymore, although I guess I'm nominally a contributing editor, but that means nothing. But I love what you do. I love podcasts. I love talk, you know, like the whole listening and talking and in this format is really, I hope it's as much of a blast to listen to as it is to produce.
Well, from the shows I listened to of yours, I was very into it, and we'll probably be going back to the archives and listening to more, which also is something I love about podcasts is that they're just available.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that was a good, you know, I've met Massimo a bunch of times, and I feel like he's a very genuine person. You know, he is sort of like a dreamer, and an artist, and really committed to being a dreamer and an artist. Like, he has no self-consciousness about being creative, and he has no self-consciousness about being... whimsical is like a little bit dismissive. That's not what I mean. It's more like fantastical, and he has no fear creatively that I've seen. And that's really rare. And I think that comes from a lot of success. Like he's made it. I think he's had a lot of help from Laura, his wife, making it. You know, like he's allowed and able to dream in that way because he has a counterpart who's very grounded. But to talk to him is exhilarating. To talk to him is like talking to an artist. He happens to be a chef, but it might as well be Francis Ford Coppola on film, or, you know, Matisse, or the medium. At that level, the medium doesn't matter. It's like the spirit.
No, he's amazing, and I feel very lucky. I had the opportunity to dine at his restaurant, Osteria Francescana, and then he came on. He was been on my podcast. He was in New York a couple years ago, and I was able to do an interview with him. And it's just he's
was that the Bread is Gold tour?
It was more tied to he was involved. It was at Italy. There was I'm blanking on the name of the organization that organized.
Identità Galosso.
Yeah, exactly. They had a series of events at Italy, and that's when I was able to connect with him.
Oh, nice.
So, it was wonderful. It was great about your interview with him was, you know, hearing him talk about his kids and that you brought his daughter onto the show and he's just so real, you know?
Yeah. I feel like it's hard for people to keep all of their defenses and facades up when you're relating to them as parents. Now, it doesn't mean you can relate to everyone as a parent because some people's realities are so different than yours that when they talk about being a parent, I hardly recognize the experience. But for a lot of people, you know, we all have those feelings of love for our kids, and that's genuine. So I found doing that podcast that if I could connect with my guests on that level, it didn't matter how famous they were, you kind of cut through all of the media training.
Right. Yeah, because it's so personal what you're talking about that it just naturally you get like the real deal. Not to say I didn't get the real deal, but the subject matter of our talk was a little different.
Yeah, for sure.
So let me ask you my question for my last guest on episode 294. I had on Judy Ann Wu. She's an independent marketing and culinary consultant. She's the host of a new podcast called Food People Are the Best People, which is on the Eat, Drink, Dine podcast network. And she wants to know, do you have any words of wisdom as a father to a father? What's the best advice you could give to raising children who are self-sufficient, thoughtful, caring human beings that we want to see in this world? And she also noted how she takes parenting very seriously and she loves being a parent.
Can I curse on the show?
Yes, you may.
Deal with your own shit. You know, like...
Great advice.
how we treat our kids that's problematic has to do with the fact that we haven't processed a lot of our own issues, and everyone has issues, and great, that's what makes us, part of what makes us human. But if you're blind to them, then that's what you're passing on to your kids. That could be really harmful.
Well, yeah, that's great advice, as I said. Perfect.
And you don't have to have kids to deal with your own shit either.
Very true. Yes, yeah. We all should deal with our own shit, for sure. So what else, what's next for you? What's in the pipeline? Like 10 more books this year?
Yeah, a bunch of books. Let's see. I have a children's book coming out in November called Solitary Animals. And then I have a book with Joe Campanale, another Heritage Radio host.
Yes.
Called Vino, which is coming out in 2022. Kwame Onwachi and I wrote another book. It's a cookbook. That's also coming out in 2022.
Amazing.
Then I have another children's book called Lunch from Home, which I think is coming out in 2022. So my schedule is usually every other year is like slightly heavier. So this year was, what is this book called? Cooking for Your Kids. And, I think Invisible Alphabet was this year too.
I was going to ask you how many books you've done. Do you know?
So many. 7, 10, 10 maybe? 8?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think it's more.
You think so?
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah, God. Well, you know, books are... I've not reached the level in my career where I can do, like... You know, sometimes you talk to people and they're like... They're like, yeah, I've been working on this book or even like an article for 9 months. And I'm like, what are you talking? Like, how can you, if someone's working on an article for 9 months, it's like, how are you making a living? Or it's like, I can't just do one book per year. I'm not there yet. So I really do out of necessity. And to be honest, out of choice. I like to have a bunch of different projects because there's something about like, cross-pollination, which I really enjoy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I like to be busy and wear multiple hats too. You certainly do. And you certainly, yeah. I mean, because also I have it on a tab to finish reading, but I saw, I think today or yesterday, you came out with an article on Grub Street on Anthony Bourdain's new documentary, Roadrunner.
Yeah.
So you're also, I mean, between the books, you're still... You're writing on publications, you know.
Yeah, it's different. They're different muscles. It's like one's almost like a fast twitch. You do it, you're really involved in for like 2 weeks, or like that was like I saw the film, I think on a Thursday. Yeah, it was on Thursday, and then I filed that on Sunday. So it was like quite a quick turnaround. What I find about books is that they're logistically so much more challenging. It's not that they're more work. I mean, they are more work. It's not that they're more work per word. But it's more of a project to manage with a lot of moving parts and a lot more people. Because when you're putting together a book, I'm very involved in all my collaborations and, of course, in my own work. It's like every step of the way, it's such a big team. It's like, okay, well, the cover, the illustration or illustrations, photographer, design, not to mention like copy edit, not to mention edit, not to mention like conceptualizing the book itself. So there's a lot of different tasks, which is something I love about it because there are so many skills involved and so many ways of using your brain.
And you're obviously very good at it and wearing these different hats. And I've always thought of writing, especially freelance writing, is that like you really got to hustle to make it as a career, and I have so much respect for people who do it because I write. It's like I've written a couple articles here and there, and it takes me, a bit of time to write it, just to get it the way I want it. But is a you know as a full-time job, what you're doing, you got to get articles out there, and you're able to do it and do it well.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a great living, to be honest. But augmented with books, it is for now tenable.
Yeah, well, I say keep up everything you're doing. It's wonderful. So, let's take a little break here and we'll come back. We'll play my speed round game. We'll talk some industry news. I have a new solo dining experience this week and the final question. So stay with us. This is On the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm excited to partner with Tock, the only unified platform for reservations, takeout, and event management. Tock is home to 7,000 restaurants, bars, wineries, and breweries, including Danielle Ballou Kitchen, a new pickup and delivery concept designed to bring the culinary legacy of Chef Danielle Ballou to your home. So I'm a big fan of Danielle Ballou. If you recall, back on episode 293, I shared my solo dining experience at Le Pavillon by Danielle Ballou, which is a new restaurant in New York City. No matter which of his French restaurants you go to or I go to, Danielle never disappoints. And now you can experience Danielle Ballou at home. And thanks to Tock, ordering is a breeze. Check out the rotating menu of contemporary French classics rooted in the rhythm of the seasons. To learn more about how Tock powers reservations, events, and takeout, go to exploretock, that's exploretock.com/join. That's exploretock.com/join. Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Joshua David Stein. He's the author of many cookbooks, books, and children's books. And his latest is Cooking for Your Kids at Home with the World's Greatest Chefs. So, Joshua, it's time for my speed round game. What this is I'm going to name a couple things, and you get to pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla.
Sure.
Are you ready?
Yes.
All right, here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Oh. Wait a second. What do you mean, eat in or eat out? Eat in my house or eat out at a restaurant or eat in a restaurant or take out in a restaurant?
I think it's so funny because since the pandemic,
Yeah.
everyone's getting stuck on this one. And before the pandemic, no, it was like it, no, everyone understood it. It's But I'm referring to eat in, like eating in your home or eating out at a restaurant.
Yes, out.
Out, okay. But again, but this game, I have to say, can be interpreted however you want to interpret it. So
I just want to make sure I'm responding to the correct option.
For each their own, and yes, you did. Okay. How about wine, beer, cocktail, mocktail, or champagne?
Cocktail.
Tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte.
Small plates or large plates?
Large.
Communal table or chef's counter?
Ugh. Neither.
Yeah.
My own table. Can I say that?
Yes, you could. Yes, there's no rule.
I don't want to make small talk. I don't want to make small talk with like a stranger. I don't want to make small talk with a chef who doesn't really want to talk to me anyway because she's working. So
you're
on my own at a table, maybe a book.
Wonderful. Okay, tipping or all-inclusive charge?
All-inclusive.
How about memoirs, cookbooks, or children's books? My tough one of the game.
Children's books.
Ooh, fun. Writing words, drawing illustrations, or podcasting?
Words. I'm best at that.
Okay, two more. Cheese plate or dessert?
Dessert.
Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Brooklyn.
Brooklyn.
How dare you even ask?
Yeah, well, I believe you live in Brooklyn, so I was not that surprised by that one.
Yeah.
So for industry news, and that was wonderful. You played a really, really good game there, even though I confused you on the first one.
A trick question, yeah.
Okay, so for industry news, I picked out an article on Eater New York. I know this is a little New York centric here, but we live in this hood. So the article is entitled "The Debate Over the Future of Outdoor Dining is Off to a Complicated Start. Residents of Lower Manhattan Debate the Future of Outdoor Dining," and this was by Luke Fortnoy. And so this has been in the news quite a bit here, just talking about what's going to happen with outdoor dining, that since the pandemic, the open restaurants program supporting really was a lifeline to restaurants. I read it was like 11,000 restaurants and bars over the last year extended their seating to sidewalks and in parking spaces, and it really helped them survive. And so now that we're kind of past the extremeness of the pandemic, people are kind of wondering what the future is. And there's debates about the range of from safety and noise to pedestrian access and parking with having this the outdoor dining. So do you have any take on this?
I think there's something mentioned in that article that with some marginal changes to outdoor dining, the majority of pedestrians support, this was in reference to Chinatown, support the continuation of that program. And I agree with that. I think that if you're optimizing for cars, not good. If you're optimizing for the local community and pedestrians, then I think that is also important, especially you want people to feel like they're at home in their homes. It's not taken over by luxury services in a way, you know, that aren't for them in many cases. So outdoor dining forever with community input.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think I'm always for pro restaurants and I think this, you know, that a lot of these outdoor dining setups have, you know, it's changed the look of the city, but it's pretty cool. And I think, yeah, concerns, there are some concerns with safety or noise or just that there are some of these setups. It's like, it could be a little, I don't know, a little dangerous with being so close to cars going by in the street, but, I agree. I think it would be nice to see this program continuing on and supporting restaurants. And there's just people need to figure out, I guess, the further logistics of it moving forward, because it all happened. So, I mean, it was a reaction, really, yes, to what was happening, and it happened very fast.
Yes, correct.
So we'll stay tuned on that. And I know this was a New York City type situation, but I believe this type of stuff is kind of happening everywhere. We're just kind of figuring out how to move forward since things changed this past year.
Yes, not a return to the status quo, but also with community input, like a reasonable middle path.
Yes. Yes, I'm on the same page with that. So that's great. And I have my solo dining experience this week. So it is at Dame. Here's the rundown. The location, 87 McDougal Street, Soho, New York City. The concept, an English seafood-focused restaurant that began as a pop-up during the pandemic, and it turned now into a permanent location. The owners are Chef Ed Zizmansky and Patricia Howard. Why did I go? Well, I was hearing really wonderful things about this new restaurant, so I wanted to check it out. My experience. Okay, so I went online to get a reservation, and the only spots available were at 10 o'clock or 10:30, and I thought that was kind of ridiculous, but I booked it anyway because that's how I roll. But I called the restaurant because it was a reservation for two, and I was going to go solo to see if they could change that. And then while I was on the phone, I said, "Do you happen to have anything earlier?" And they did. So I changed it to 7 p.m. So there's a little tip for anyone. If you see late reservations or times that don't service you as well, you call the restaurant, because I sometimes forget to pick up the phone because I'm so used to apps and everything online. So you may be too. Okay, so I showed up. I got a table that was near the front corner of the restaurant. They were actually utilizing the outdoor space more than the indoor space, and they had the windows open, and it was a really nice spot. The service was great. I recognized from her photo, Patricia, one of the owners, and she helped take care of me as well as a server at the restaurant, and I had a really good time. What did I get? Well, I don't know. Whatever mood I was in, I just over-ordered. I got one grilled oyster with green chartreuse hollandaise. I got a couple small plates. There are smoked whitefish croquettes. I got heirloom cucumbers with mussels and dill, and also a warm lobster tart with morels and snap peas. And while I was over-ordering, I also got dessert. I got Eton Mess, and they're known actually for their fish and chips, and I didn't get the fish and chips, so that's on my list for next time. But I did do quite well in ordering. What did I get? It was all great, and it's, you know, I don't really love cucumbers, which is interesting. I ordered that dish, but funnily enough, I love these cucumbers. You know, nice preparations of food products that don't necessarily always resonate with me. So, you know, I pleasantly surprise myself when I like things more than I think I'm going to like them. The croquettes were super delicious. Lobster tart with morels. I mean, how can that not be fabulous? It was rich. It was decadent. And the dessert was sweet and messy. And I really like my whole meal. So the ambiance, it has wooden booths, and it has a marble chef's counter facing the open kitchen. They weren't using it that night. I think they're just not using the indoor space to full capacity yet, because most of the seating was on the patio. Perfect for dinner with friends or date night. Interesting tidbit, Chef Ed and Patricia apparently met while they were working at the Beatrice Inn. He is formerly the chef at Cherry Point and Green Point, which I think is now closed. And she does the wine list, and I didn't have any wine, but the wine list is pretty fun. On one side of the menu, it has what James Bond would like to drink, and on the other side, it has Austin Powers selections. So I thought that was kind of fun. Personal fun fact, while I was leaving, I ran into a food writer friend who was sitting outside and dining, and I have to say, it just feels extra special in the city when you run into people you know, because pretty much all of last year, I didn't see many people I knew. So that was fun. The cost of this meal was $82, not including tax and gratuity. Would I go back? Yes, I do want to try the fish and chips. And their website is damenewyork.com, and on Instagram, dame_NYC. My next guest is Manish Goel. He is the founder and CEO at Pineapple Company and the founder and partner at Sona, which is featuring timeless Indian cuisine in the heart of Manhattan. I talked about Sona episode 288 as a solo experience. So Joshua, can you please ask a question for Manish?
I have two. One, you have any reservations this Friday at 7:30 for two? Very popular. It's hard to get a table. But two, what are some of the challenges of presenting high-end modern Indian cuisine in the city as a fine dining experience, essentially? And does he feel like those challenges are diminishing a little bit or getting easier? And if so, to what does he attribute that?
Fabulous. I will ask him. You're amazing. Thank you so much for joining me. My guest today has been Joshua David Stein. He's the author of many cookbooks, books, and children's books. His latest is Cooking for Your Kids at Home with the World's Greatest Chefs by Fiden. His website's joshuadavidstein.com. You can follow him at Joshua David Stein. And you can follow me at Sherry Bayer at Bayer PR and at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. Websites, BayerPublicRelations.com, SherryBayer.com, and AllInTheIndustry.com. All of our shows are archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are also on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks always to my engineer today, Amanda Wang. Thanks again to Joshua and to Alex and Jill. And thanks to our sponsor, Talk. I'm Sherry Bayer. I'll be back next week with a new show. Stay safe and well, and thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye. All in the Industry is powered by Simplecast. I'm Sherry Bayer, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.